The following episode of the Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD, specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray. Please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Hey, this is William Cat, and you're in the Projection Booth with Mike and Justin.
When Big Wednesday came out in 1978, it was a failure. It was a critical failure. It was a financial failure. Surfers didn't even like it. But somehow, 30 years later, now it's considered, you know, a cult classic, and even surfers that didn't like it then, now they love it. And I think the reason why that is so is that the values that Big Wednesday expressed are sort of timeless. It's about friendship, and it's about, you know, it's about that shared experience that these guys had, and it's about, as the years pass, how important friendship is.
Everybody's doing a brand new dance now.
Come on, baby, do the locomotion.
I know you get to like it if you give it a chance now.
Come on, baby, do the locomotion.
My little baby sister can do it with me. It's easier than learning your ABC. So come on, come on, do the locomotion with me.
Cowabunga! Welcome to yet another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Pipeline Mike, and with me, barreling through the liquid tunnel, is Mondo Justin.
That's right. On this week's show, we're taking a look back at 1978's Big Wednesday, and we'll be playing back an interview I did with one of the stars of the film, Mr. Jack Barlow himself, William Catt.
So yeah, why didn't you get Gary Busey or Jan Michael Vincent?
Yeah, you know, I tried. You know, I exchanged emails with Jan. You know, he just wasn't interested in coming on the show. And then Busey, you know, it was looking like I was going to get him, and then he just sort of kind of, you know, disappeared off the face of email Earth.
So I imagine he probably heard our show on Dead Ringer and thought we were going to get Meatloaf on his ass or something. You know, it's tough because I really would have liked to have spoken to him about Tribulation. That's one of my favorite Rapture exploitation films.
Well, truth be told, I'd actually really like to talk to him too, particularly about, you know, the work he did in Carney with Jodie Foster, and then also Nick Rogue's Insignificance.
Without further ado, 1978's Big Wednesday was written and directed by the one and only John Milius, a man among men. It's the story of three lifelong friends, and the film spans 12 years in their lives, and examines not only Southern California surf culture, but also the friendships of the three guys, normal men who by some are considered to be surfing legends, but really maintain and struggle with not just life, coming of age, adulthood, responsibility, but friendship, celebrity, nostalgia, and the fact that the Vietnam War is looming in the distance.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and also, I think it's important to note that the film is really this sort of big homage to the films and director John Ford. And, you know, before we head right out into those proverbial waters here, I want to take a quick look back at Big Wednesday. Here's the audio trailer.
Big Wednesday, the day you face your own biggest challenge, the day you risk it all, the day you either distinguish yourself or fade into the crowd.
It'll come again. It'll be a swell so big and strong it'll wipe clean everything that went before it. That's the day this board will be written. And that's when Matt and Jack and Leroy, they could distinguish themselves.
It was their time. They were the kings.
I can't
sit down!
Sharing the great adventure of being young together. Jan Michael Vincent is Matt Johnson, a reluctant hero to a generation that would forget him. Billy Catt is Jack. He was the first to accept responsibility. Gary Busey is Leroy, the masochist, a careful student of the art of being reckless. Big Wednesday, the story of a generation, of every generation, growing up, leaving home, changing. Some marry, some die, some search for a new spot.
It's gonna be like nothing anybody has ever seen.
Now is the moment of truth. Now is the time of decision. And for Matt, Jack, and Leroy, Judgment Day is here. Big Wednesday.
Okay, so, you know, right off the bat, I want to say that I love Big Wednesday. You know, it's one of my very favorite films. I know I say that a lot, but it truly is one of my favorite films. And quite honestly, you know, it brings me to tears most times when I revisit it, you know. Now, when I informed you that we'd be covering the film, like, you know, you never gave me that, oh, great, I love Big Wednesday response, you know. So I'm really curious here to get some kind of initial thoughts from you. Like, are you a fan of Big Wednesday or not?
Well, you know, this was actually the first time I'd ever seen it. I had bought it years and years ago when there was a local video store that was closing out. And I was like, oh, cool, Big Wednesday, John Milius, I can't wait to see this. And that was maybe, you know, 10 years ago. And it finally took me until this last, I figured, you know, watch it on Wednesday, this last Big Wednesday, and I finally checked it out.
You know, and what's really funny is, you know, here we are, we're, you know, like the two Midwestern guys, and, you know, granted we are in Michigan, so we're in the Great Lakes state, but yeah, there's no surfing around here, obviously, and but I've always kind of been fascinated with surfing, you know, just watching movies growing up, like North Shore and then Big Wednesday, and, you know, so I have this real specific, like, ideology in my head about, you know, surfing in California in general, you know, being from the Midwest. And so, you know, I always look at it as this sort of spiritual thing, you know, and it's really fascinating because in Big Wednesday, you know, you get that as well. But also ultimately what it comes down to is this movie is about friendship, and Jan Michael Vincent sort of sums, you know, this ideology up for me in the sense that, you know, he says, I just wanted to be with my friends. So, I mean, being from the Midwest, do you know, what do you think about that? Like, have you ever had, what are some of your ideals, like, about California and surfing?
Well, yeah, Lake Erie, not really the best surfing climate, not even for, like, you know, boogie boards or anything. So I've never really been surfing, never really had the bug to surf. And really the only exposure I've had to it has been through TV and movies. And, you know, I pretty much got scared out of my wits seeing one of the Brady Boys just kind of take a header and almost, you know, kill himself there because of the tiki idol. So I've never really had the urge to dive into deeper waters.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's, you know, I grew up as like skateboarder, love skateboarding, and there's always kind of that idea in my head that someday I'd get to surf. And so, you know, I guess we live out our fantasies through television and movies to a certain extent.
Yeah, I never had the balance to skateboard or anything, so
nice.
I can't even imagine what I would be like. I've never even gotten up on what do you call those things? Water skis. So, you know, I'm me and the water, we don't go together too well. So, but yeah, I can definitely see, you know, there is that whole spiritual thing that is portrayed in the movies. I mean, you know, like the guys from Point Break are pretty much like Zen masters at some point. Zen masters who happen to rob banks and stuff, but still, you know, the Patrick Swayze character is definitely very into the ocean and that whole, like, you know, the spirituality of it, man, and 100% pure adrenaline. Woo!
You know, what I like about Big Wednesday so much is just how it's sort of like this classic, like, textbook, you know, example of metaphor, you know, cinematic metaphors in film. You know, there's just so many, like, blatant instances in the film where they just stick out. And also, you know, there's a novelization of the film, too. And, you know, those are really, it's really visible in the book as well, just the blatant metaphors, you know, and like just instantly I'm reminded of, and it's probably my favorite metaphorical aspect of Big Wednesday too, is it's called, you see in the film, it's just a gate that they enter at the beginning of the film down to the beach. And it's, you know, it's the final shot of the movie as well. And in the book, it's actually called the Whitney Gate. And, you know, mm-hmm. I love this gate because it's sort of, you know, it's like this perfect bookend to the film, you know? And, you know, in the novel, that gives you this rich history about the gates too. You know, they once belonged to this house, and it was like this beachfront mansion that sort of like is dying, decrepit. And then, you know, it's in the book, they talk about how it's rumored to an actor. Like, I think they said Robert Mitchum was rumored to live there in the book. And I just really love it. It's sort of like, you know, if you really sit down and analyze or think about it, it's kind of like, because of the way the film plays. And it's, for me, it's kind of like this dream state, you know, this sort of remembrance of old times. And so it kind of, you know, it's like those guys coming down that gate is, you know, how John Milius remembers this in his mind. You know, it's mm-hmm. like the perfect entrance. You know, it's like, this is how I want to remember this, And, you know, so what better way for them to enter into the story through this passageway? You know, it could be like the mind or heaven or, you know, what have you. It's just, it's kind of blows my mind just how blatant these metaphors are in this movie.
Right, yeah. It's a little, you know, the Secret Garden or entering into their own Narnia, as it were. But, yeah, the thing I was surprised about watching The Big Wednesday was just how little surfing there was in the film. You know, I was like, oh, well, this is going to be, you know, I don't know. I was thinking at least like 45-55% of the film was going to be surfing. So then when it was just kind of these like, I don't know, not breaks in it, but it was like, you're right though. They kind of like shrug off the regular world as they go through these gates and get out into the water and stuff. And it's like their time to be themselves. And then they've got the real world outside of that gate and, you know, outside of the beach and stuff. So yeah, I found that very interesting to see how they were using the surfing parts to kind of contrast against the rest of the story. Because it was like, you know, this is purity, this is motion, this is just us, you know, being friends and, you know, convening with the ocean or whatever. And then the rest of it was, you know, not that great. You know, they kind of had some shitty stuff going on when they weren't on the water.
Well, yeah. And then also, you know, I think the water is, again, another metaphor as well, you know, in the sense that, you know, it's each time they hit the waves seems to represent some sort of changing in their life, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going back to what I said earlier about the friendships, you know, there's this crazy, like, over nostalgic feeling to it, and you know, I like that it exists in this almost sort of, it's almost like it's an alternate world. Do you know, like, you're stuck in these just a select amount of people's lives and you don't see a lot of outside. You know, you don't see them going to work, you just see them being friends and hanging out and doing what they love. And I love that about it, and I think for me it triggers that remembrance of my own life in terms of, you know, you have your special friends that you grow up and you spend your adolescence with. And I think that's why the film works for me. I mean, that's definitely the attraction for me, is just how nostalgic it is. And you know, it all ties into the metaphors for me.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And then what are your thoughts on the pier? I mean, that's kind of reaching out into it. And what do you see for that?
Well, the pier, it's another symbol in the sense that, you know, you have Bear, you know, living on the pier, and, you know, Bear's kind of, you know, like you and I talked about this earlier, Bear's sort of like their mentor in a sense, and you know, he kind of, the pier for me kind of represents like, look, like this is a symbol of the last, you know, like Bear says in the movie, like, you know, there's going to be a wave that's going to erase everything. And so I think like the pier is kind of like, you know, that last, you know, kind of like image of that previous time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you know, watching the story, you know, the pier is condemned. So it's like, it's kind of, you know, sort of foreshadowing what's going to happen later on.
Yeah, you know, the thing I found interesting, and I know we'll talk about the novel a little bit more as we go along, but, you know, I guess maybe if you can give a little bit of the history of the production and stuff, because I'm very curious as far as how much of this was Milius's life, you know, because during the audio commentary, he's talking about like how he wanted to write a book. This was going to be his, you know, thing, was to write this book about his life and the surfing and all this kind of stuff. So there were times when I was watching this film where I felt like there was a lot more to the story that I wasn't getting. And I don't know if that's the same thing that you have, or since you've read the book, if you get more of the inside story, or if it's just, you know, the film stands on its own, you know, because it feels like one of those, like, I don't know, I don't want to say pet project or vanity project or something like that, but it feels like one of those things where it is so personal to the filmmaker that sometimes some of the edges get a little blurry as far as what's real, what's his life, what's not, what's just for the film. So, because it's a very uniquely structured film, you know, it doesn't feel like it's really following, you know, three distinct acts and everything, even though they have the breaks in the film to show the title cards of where they're at in their life, it doesn't feel super easy to be like, oh yeah, that's the end of act one, and that's the end of act, you know, there's definitely more, it's more of a, what's the word, like a serial kind of a thing.
Yeah, absolutely, but I think on that point too, I think that's why it works for me too, is because, like I said, it seems like it's just these little glimpses into someone's memory, you know, and it's kind of like, I like to think of it as like, it's the way he remembered it, you know, well, it's, you know, and we tend to want to remember, you know, things poetically or, you know, visually, and like that are romantic. And so I think that's why it works for me too, is that there is, you know, there isn't more to the story. And, you know, that's, I guess we can segue into the novel, because that's one thing that's really interesting with the film versus the novel too, is, you know, because the Big Wednesday is a sort of homage to John Ford, and like, you know, how Sam Peckinpah sort of like idolized, you know, men and made them gods. And, you know, here you have that as well, but you also, you know, you have these guys as gods in the movie, and I like them that way. Like, I don't want to know more about them. And the thing about the book that kind of kills me is the fact is it sort of takes away that myth, and it makes these guys just humans, mm-hmm. just normal guys, you know, just normal buddies that have, you know, problems. And it's like, it's almost, the book is almost too personal. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it gives you so much of a, there's a more of a, like a characterization in the book. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that in the book. I like, maybe it's probably because I saw the movie first, but I like that they're these sort of like men, you know, gods among men in the movie, and in the book they're just normal guys.
Well, if they're gods, they're definitely very flawed gods. I mean, the Jan Michael Vincent character is, you know, he's, Jan Michael Vincent to me is the most dynamic character that's in the film, because, you know, he's, even though it seems like it's really, to me, it feels like William Catt's story, you know, like, you know, to me, I thought that it was him narrating the story. You know, you say that it's Robert Englund, but for me, it sounded like William Catt. So I was like, okay, this is him talking about this. And for me, he was really kind of the linchpin to the story, because he was the most together of the three guys. And then, you know, Busey for me kind of drops out a little bit. Like, I don't really see him 100% of the time, you know, like all the time in the story. So it's like, you know, there are times where I'm just like, man, I wish Busey was back on screen, because it really feels like William Catt's the main character, and then Jan Michael Vincent is kind of, you know, the screwed up guy that they're trying to get onto the right path, and then Busey's just kind of there being Busey, you know, waiting to join the FBI later on and get with Johnny Utah and stuff. But yeah, so I'm curious, you know, are you saying gods with like an uppercase G or gods with a lowercase G? I mean, because there is that whole, you know, arc of Jan Michael Vincent going through a lot of problems.
I would say with a lower G, and then I'd also say the god that is John Wayne. How's that? In the sense that these guys are very, I mean, they're men among men, and, you know, everyone in their community sort of idolizes them too, you know, but they're also these three really close friends, you know? So, I mean, in the book, again, it's that whole theory is just totally debunked for me. It's, you know, it's demystified in the sense that you just get more of their personalities. And I don't like that. Maybe if I had read the book first, then, you know, I'd be fine with it. But because I've seen the film so many times and read the book, it's, you know, it's just one of those things that I like so much about the movie. And maybe that ties in for me to the nostalgic point of view too, because I just tend to think about Big Wednesday in terms of how I remember my own memories of adolescence. And so, like, you know, you don't think back about your friends as, you know, oh, and that guy had problems. It was, you know, you see them in your head as just, they're your friends, and you see a singular image, and you don't think, oh, that's Andy. He, you know, he was a drinker. Mm-hmm. And maybe you do, but, you know, you just tend to have this sort of singular vision in your head when you think back about people. Yeah, you know, I don't know.
Unfortunately, I see all the flaws and I don't see the good points. So all those bastards that I'm still friends with, I just see all their bad points all the time.
Nice.
So, I'm talking to you, Leon.
So, yeah. And then, you know, for me as well, it's really interesting that you see, you know, William Catt is the lead role, because for me, I actually see Jan Michael Vincent in the lead role. Mm-hmm. And it is because there is so much personal growth for him. And, you know, the acting in the film is just spectacular. You know, and I think Jan Michael Vincent really stands out as well, because, you know, he has a lot of really interesting, like, subtle nuances in the film. And I'm actually thinking right away about that scene when William Catt's character is going off to war, and mm-hmm. Jan Michael Vincent's the last one to leave. And William Catt says, you know, take care of these people for me. And he's like, huh, me? You know, it's like, he's definitely the most complex character in the film.
Oh yeah.
You know, and it's really fabulous to see, you know, his growth over the course of the film too. I really like that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Like I said, he definitely is the most dynamic person in the film, but I guess, I don't know. It's like, I guess I see Cat as being the linchpin that kind of holds everything together. Even though, like I said, he goes off and you don't really see when he's, you know, in Vietnam. You see him leave, you see him come back. But I guess because he is the most stable, and it just felt like he was the most, I don't know, introverted, the most contemplative, I guess would be the right word, where it just, it feels like he's the guy that's really kind of keeping this whole group together. And I think it was very important for him to tell Jan Michael Vincent, you know, to watch over people, because he wasn't going to be there for him. And that was kind of his job, it felt like to me. But I don't know. You know, I really enjoy Jan Michael Vincent in this movie. There aren't that many times where I can be like, oh yeah, Jan Michael Vincent gave a really great performance in this film, you know, but this is one of them. So, I mean, Jan Michael Vincent, well, I will say also, he was like fucking buff in this movie, man. Like, there were so many times where they're just like showing his arms and stuff. I'm just like, man, that guy's cut, man. He is ripped, you know? And so, yeah, he definitely is the guy who you want. He's like the guy you want to be friends with, you know. He's the guy that you want to have around, and that's why it really tears my heart out when you see him, when he's having problems like with alcohol and I don't know. I was blindsided watching this when his girlfriend announces that she's pregnant. I was just like, where the hell did that come from? You know, that's not supposed to happen in this movie. These people are supposed to just have a good time and F around and stuff.
Listen, I love that scene, and I love her. I love the actress's Lea Purcell, and, you know, she's so great, and she's such a standout for me in this movie, too. She's so good. And that's why I think it's just such a well-written script that there's so much depth to those characters. Mm-hmm. You know, then that's at that point you realize that this is going to be something more than just a fun surfing movie.
Exactly.
You know, this is going to be a real serious film. And then, you know, real quick, going back to the William Cat, I do see your point there. You know, and that's one thing that I have a huge problem with in terms of the book, too, is, you know, and you'll hear later in the interview with William Cat, but, you know, one of the most kind of profound moments for me in the film is when William Cat comes back from the war and mm-hmm. goes to see his girlfriend, Sally, and, you know, he sees that she's married. And so I could never really get around that. Like, why did he not do more? You know, why did he go the extra mile to, you know, try to win her back? And he just walks away and that's it. You know, that really kind of frustrated me, made me sad. And so, you know, reading the novel, in the novel, it's quite a bit different in the sense that, you know, eventually he does put more effort into it, and they do actually see each other one more time. And it's this really heartbreaking passage in the book where they and it's kind of typical of Milius too, because, you know, as much as I love Milius as a writer, like, you know, he's kind of short on adjectives and you know, so, you know, when he describes a woman, it's not like a voluptuous beauty in the film. In the book, he writes a big-chested woman. That's something he writes, like, you know. But in the book, with this scene, you know, they meet again and they make love one more time, and then they kind of hug and kiss each other, and then, you know, they both leave in tears, and that's the end of their relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, it's a struggle, because I would love to find out if there was other stuff shot for the film that didn't make the final cut, because, you know, in the book, you know, on the back of the book, there are some still photographs of some scenes that aren't in the movie. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you know, that something, there was probably quite a bit extra shot, you know, that's not in the movie.
Well, yeah,
that's pretty frustrating to me.
Yeah, like I was saying earlier, it feels like there's a whole lot to this world, and whether that be outside of the pages or that there was more shot to it, because this thing, you know, I won't say rambling because there's bad connotations with that, but this thing is like this big epic, you know, and it does feel like, you know, even at 2 hours, that they probably had to cut out a whole bunch of stuff, because this feels like one of these, like, okay, guys, we're going to shoot this, we're going to shoot that, and, you know, kind of pull it all together in the editing room to see how it can all fit.
This is a movie that gave a lot of people sort of like their start, you know, like, this was the first film, big film with William Katz. This is a really big film for Gary Busey, Jan Michael Vincent. You have an amazing cameo by one of my favorite actors, Joe Spinell.
Oh, yeah.
And then you've got your friend and mine, Frank McCray, from your favorite movie, Last Action Hero, in there.
Mm-hmm.
You got Reb Brown, Robert Englund, I said, and then Perry Lang, of course, who was in The Big Red One, which we covered earlier this year. And like I said, Lee Purcell. You have the dad of James and Stacey Keach in there as well. And then you also have Barbara Hale, which, you know, if anyone who's listening doesn't know, you know, Barbara Hale is actually William Cath's real mother. And she was, of course, known by playing Della Street on the Perry Mason series. And so it's really great to see all these people, you know, in this film. And it's like, it's kind of mind blowing for me that, you know, all these people got their start with this great movie. It's something they've got to be proud of.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was very surprised to see William Cat as the protagonist in this, because I don't really think of him as a movie actor, but just because I grew up with him on Greatest American Hero. So I just associate him with that so much. Though I know, like, you know, then I can think of, like, Carrie, and then I know he was in some of your favorite Dan Golden films and stuff. But, yeah, for me, it was just like, wow, William Cat is a movie star. That's so weird. And then the thing I kept thinking is, man, he's going to get burned out there. He's so fair-skinned.
Yeah, he's on the edge of albinoism.
Yeah. Well, there was one part, too, where he was just, his face was so red. I was like, oh, my gosh. What's going on there?
And he's so thin compared to how you're used to seeing him.
God.
And he looks like, if you actually Google it, you'll look and see, Google him, look at his dad, and his dad is, I mean, they're like the spitting image of each other, you know. And what a lot of people don't know is that his dad was actually in the original King Kong.
Ah.
So he grew up, you know, this Hollywood sort of brat. So, you know, and what's, you know, and you and I talked about this before off mic, and, you know, we should probably talk a little about, you know, you've got Jan Michael Vincent, who's, you know, everyone kind of knows what's going on with him these days. And you've got Busey, who's sort of become this larger than life, you know, TMZ kind of, you know, everyone, he's the punchline of a lot of jokes. And then you have William Cat. And so it's like really fascinating for me, because it's, in a sense, you know, what happened to these actors in real life is kind of what happened to them over the course of the film. It's sort of like this great, you know, case of life imitating art, in the sense. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, if only they had if only they had Gary Busey on a motorcycle being like, I don't need to wear a helmet. What are you talking about?
Oh, poor Gary.
I know.
Poor Gary.
He's just been so scrambled over the years. But yeah, Jan Michael Vincent, you know, just plagued by drugs and stuff, and seeing him struggling with alcohol in this, you're just like, oh, hey, you know. It's just, yeah, it's weird, man. It's just so weird to see them in that. And I have to go back, and I have to apologize to William Cat, because I forgot that he was in the House movies, and I love House, and that's House without the party on it. That's the horror films that I enjoy so much.
It would have been awesome if he was in House Party, though.
That would be great, man. Him and Kid and Play dancing, doing like a three-way up there, just kind of stepping and stuff.
Right. Doing that. Doing that kick dance?
Or doing the one where you grab onto your leg and you jump through it with the other leg?
Yeah, the kick dance. Oh, yeah, how awesome would that be?
Love that.
You know, you mentioned earlier about John Milius in the film, you know, and so, you know, he's actually in the film twice.
Really?
And yeah, he's in the film, of course. He's the Latino drug dealer in the Mexico sequence.
Where, like,
and
the
then
entire movie just stops, and it's like, marijuana. Exactly.
That's awesome. And then and then it's really interesting is there's a you know, and it kind of ties into what I said earlier about the nostalgia, and because, you know, the film opens with this montage of still photos, you know, showing the glory days, and if you watch the actual final the freeze frame on the credits the last frame before it goes into the movie is a black and white photo of Milius as a younger guy.
Oh, nice. Nice.
So, and then, you know, I love that he wrote this story, because, you know, he wrote some really great movies. And then it's really funny to see, like, the progression, too, because you've got Big Wednesday, the surfing movie. You've got Surfing in Apocalypse Now, which he wrote.
Oh, yeah.
And then you've got that rare outtake scene from Conan where Conan's surfing. And that got cut out. There should have been a Conan scene where he was surfing.
See your enemies driven before you, steal their boards, and hang 10.
Yeah, because they overdubbed it, and it was, instead of Valaria, it was I Must Have a Wave.
Yes.
So,
Yeah, and then, Milius is just a fascinating character to me. I mean, he had his fingers in so many projects, you know, throughout the 70s. You know, I mean, he was down with like Lucas and Spielberg and, you know, Coppola and all these guys. And, you know, that there's the story that he wrote the Indianapolis story. I know some people will be like, oh, no, Robert Shaw wrote that, or he came up with that, just, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it feels like such a Milius thing to do, to have that monologue in the middle of Jaws. And that just, you know, just really takes you right into the, you know, the Quint character and stuff. But anyway, but yeah, it was just, he was involved with so many things, and he's such a character. And it's like, I wish that they would do one of those like Milius on Milius kind of books, you know, how they were doing that whole book series for a while, the Twain director series and stuff.
I would love it.
Man. Yeah. 'Cause he is just fascinating, you know, and like that they based Walter from Big Lebowski on him and stuff. You know, it's like, I want to know how much of that really is him. You know, does he not bowl on the Sabbath, you know? But yeah, I mean, he's written some great stuff, he's directed some great stuff, and just some of the most, you know, the reason I called him a man among men is he's just like the most testosterone kind of guy, you know, like doing Conan,
yeah,
Red Dawn and all this stuff. It's just like, yeah, you know, Flight of the Intruder and stuff. It's like, this guy's just, yeah. And then I have to say too that I love his early work as well, like Dillinger, that he, I think
Dillinger,
that,
right?
Yeah, that was like a Corman film with Warren Oates and stuff.
Warren Oates, yep.
So good, you know.
It would have been awesome, I think. Well, actually, that's, sorry to cut you off, but I think
no problem.
To perfectly sum up Milius is like the Ernest Hemingway of filmmakers.
I can see that. You know, I would say like he and Joe Esterhaz should get together sometime and really battle it out, because I can see both of those guys trying to go for that title, but I would say Milius would win hands down.
So, you know, one thing too I want to talk about is the music in the film, because it's sort of really important, because it, you know, it sort of comments on the situation in front of you. And what I like about it is it's these great pop songs of the time, and you know, if you watch, the pop songs are sort of infinitely strung together one after the other, very, you know, like a la American Graffiti. And then if you watch that music ends when they hit the Vietnam draft sequence. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it becomes just the score. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah. And it is a terrific score. Basil Poliderus, I don't, you know, forgive me for butchering his name, but who Milius had worked with before, you know, he then would subsequently, I mean, he does the Conan score, which is one of the best scores to me, you know, just so, you know, so operatic and so, you know, driving and stuff. And this one, it really showed me that he was not just a one-note composer. He had, like, so much more going for him. And this was, yeah, it was really nice music going on during those surfing scenes.
And it's really great, too, because that score is very Western movie-ish. Mm-hmm. If you listen to it, it reminds you of Horses, you know, on the Prairie, or Horses in Monument Valley, which is, I think, is another really great tie into John Ford as well.
So on that note, let's get to the interview that Justin did with William Catt. Believe it or not, I'm walking on air about this.
Just stop it. Did you have to audition? How did you get involved with Big Wednesday?
Big Wednesday, I John Milius called me, or an associate of John's called me. And they brought me to the set, and I sat on the sofa with Jan and Gary. Mm-hmm. And we just goofed off for a couple hours together. We had a nice chemistry between the three of us. We were all significantly different from one another, but we seemed to like each other. And I think John liked what he saw. He was old school. He had confidence in himself that he was able to make those decisions without having to go through a plethora of casting sessions, you know?
Right. And then
my hat's off to him. That's what he did with pretty much with all the cast, you know?
So, you know, Milius has actually said, you know, he thought you were a pretty good recreational surfer prior to starting filming on Big Wednesday. And so, yeah, and that you got actually better over the course of the filming. So I wanted to, do you think that's true, or were you a better surfer than you thought you were right off the bat?
No, I was, you know, by the time we were doing that film, I was not surfing like I had all the time, but I thought I was a pretty good surfer. But, you know, I had surfed since I was 10, 11 years old, you know, at least 4 days a week, up until that time. But, you know, I had stopped just before the film. I stopped for quite a while while I was working in Hollywood and doing a lot of theater and traveling. And then when I got the film, I really took it up again, and I got back in the saddle and made a giant effort. And I thought I did a real good job. Of course, you can't compete with PT, who was my stunt double, who was number one in the world at the time. I mean, there's just no comparison.
Right.
You know?
And,
but
you know,
but I thought I was pretty good.
And also, you know, Milius has also said that one of the reasons why he cast you was because you had this, like, sort of quasi, like, Jimmy Stewart appeal to you. And so I wanted to see how that resonated with you. Is that, I mean, do you take that as a compliment?
Oh, Jesus. I don't know. I don't know. It's so long ago. I don't even think I'm the same person that I was then. I think I was a much better actor then. I think that I've done so many projects now that have tainted me. I don't think that I'm the actor that I once was. I'm different now. I rely on other things, and I'm more comfortable with me than I was then. Jimmy Stewart, no, I wouldn't go. I wouldn't put me in the same boat with Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy Stewart was one of our icons. Jesus Christ, I mean, he was a giant star, and I don't think of myself in the same way. No.
So, reading this script, getting this role, you know, I know we just talked a little bit about, you know, maybe how you approach characters, good or bad, but you know, you got someone very straight edge like Jack Barlow. So, I mean, how do you prepare for that? Is there any kind of method outside of the surfing? Like, I mean, you were in the military reserves at one point, right? So do you use that to your advantage in terms of this role?
Yeah. I was in the reserves. I did 6 months on active duty and then 3 weeks every summer, and I was in it for my 6 years. So I spent a lot of time in and around the military, and then when I would go and do theater for 6-8 months, then I'd have to come back and do all my time all at once. I just tried to Big Wednesday, I was always just me. I mean, that was pretty much me.
Okay.
But me acting with Jan and Gary, you know, those guys, you know, when they were on screen, they kind of sucked the air out of the room, and I just tried to compete, you know, as best I could.
Gotcha. So, you know, obviously you worked with your mom a few times over the years, and currently, you know, since you're talking about Big Wednesday, you worked with your mom on Big Wednesday. So is your mom ever critical of your work when you're sharing a scene? Like, is there any kind of mother's intuition? I mean, is she like a second director for you? Does she give you any, you know, Bill, why are you doing this? Or you shouldn't do that. Why'd you raise your arm? Is there any kind of mom director relationship going on when you're working with her?
Oh yeah. When I would work her, you know, one of the first things I remember is her coming home and my dad coming home and running. I used to love to run lines with them, you know, for their scripts for the next day. And then as I got older and I started working as an actor, they used to love to run lines with me, particularly my mom. And what was great about that is hearing another actor speak those lines and be believable. And it makes a big difference in the work of it. But in terms of shading and interpretation of a character, yeah, she would make some suggestions sometimes, and I would think about it. But you know, she always knows that that it's so subjective, so she leaves room for interpretation.
You know, shooting Big Wednesday, I heard that while you guys were shooting some of the surfing scenes, that you would see a lot of sharks swimming around pretty close to you guys. What was that like?
Yeah. Well, when we, you know, I had not been around too many sharks. I mean, in Mexico, I'd surfed a few times and there'd been sharks in the water, but we get out pretty quickly. But when we flew down to El Salvador, a lot of that footage was shot in El Salvador. And we, McGillivray brought a helicopter down, and the Bronze Ozzie, Peter Town, and Ian Carnes, a bunch of guys, Lance Carson, Jan Michael went down there with me. Gary was the only one that really didn't come down to that area. He was busy shooting another film. But there was about 40 of us down there in El Salvador, and there was a beach break that was really far out called Sunsol. And the water was extremely warm and very polluted. And at the time, we were replicating, you know, surfers from the 60s, and there was no leashes on the boards. So we would go out there and you'd lose your boards and you'd be a half a mile out in the ocean, and you'd have to make this swim in, and you'd see in the water all over the place. You'd see these, not big sharks, but, you know, 3-4 foot sharks swimming around. Even through the white water, you'd see them. And it was pretty disconcerting. But we always had our numbers on our side, and guys like Dan Merkel and George Greeno were swimming with the cameras. And so we figured that the odds were that they'd get bit before us. So we didn't do much work about it.
Jesus.
Yeah, I remember Jay Riddle was down there, and a couple guys. I mean, there was some nasty stuff out there. There were some water snakes that we saw a couple times that were pretty bad. But no, fortunately, no one ever got bit. Everybody got sick as hell because down there they were pumping raw sewage into the water. And, geez, the camera crew and all the servers, everybody, after 6-7 weeks, everybody had lost like 20, 25 pounds. We were so bloody sick.
And didn't you end up in the hospital because of that?
Well, not in the hospital, but everybody ended up going to UCLA to some kind of medical thing to find out what was going on, and a lot of people had even dysentery. And Jesus, if you look at that film, I am just incredibly skinny at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we started our main production unit started a couple months after we got back from El Salvador.
And didn't you guys run into like some military trouble in El Salvador too?
Yeah. Well, they were that big junta was taking place there. There was a war going on. I remember Jan coming back to the camp. The family of 14 ruled the country at the time, and there was an uprising. I believe it was a family of 14. I have to go back in my history. It was 1977, I think we shot that, 78. And I think there was a civil war or a junta. Don't quote me on this. You'd have to. But they would march. I remember seeing like military with AK-47s marching a guy with an X shaved in his head down the street in San Salvador. It was pretty scary. You know, the military was everywhere. There was garrisons on every corner.
Didn't you guys like? I think I read some story about like how the military accused the crew of being CIA. And were you involved in that day when they tried to offer to smoke weed with them or something to convince them that they were a film crew?
No, that must have been Jan. That wasn't me. That wasn't me.
So
I must have missed that one.
So how close do you three become working on this film?
Well, we became pretty close. I still see Gary all the time. We talk all the time.
And you guys would go off. And I mean, is there any truth to the rumors? I mean, I've read Milius saying that you guys would go off and party late at night and get in trouble and come back.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, we got in trouble. From the first night we flew down to El Paso, the three of us to bond in order to bond for the film. I forget who had it, but Jan or Gary had a bottle of mezcal and other accoutrement, and we started in, and we went into Juarez when you could still go to Juarez, and we stayed up all night, and we came to the first shot, which was under the bridge in the movie when they all have that Woody. And the girls are there, and the Woody's been broken into, and they all congregate there, and they head back to the United States. That was the first scene that we shot in the movie. Gary and Jan and I, none of us had been to sleep that night. We were all just completely toast in the morning. and it never stopped. It was like that for the whole shoot.
And you still own your big Wednesday surfboard too, right?
Yeah, I still have it. I think PT has one too.
Being a younger man, you know, growing up in the 60s, you know, I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about maybe how accurate or how well Big Wednesday captures that era, in the sense that you've got these kids trying to figure out ways to get out of the draft. I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about, you know, maybe, you know, what you thought growing up in those times and you know, what you encountered versus what we see in the film to maybe someone that didn't live through that time.
Well, you know, a Big Wednesday was really exclusively about a small coastal ribbon of life here in Southern California. I think it was very unique. It wasn't like anywhere else. It was like its own tribe of people. And I remember in that era, I mean, it spoke to an era just the generation just before me, to a little bit older generation. But that was my older sister's generation, and But I was there and involved with, that was the draft era. They don't have a draft now. But for any young man coming out of high school, man, the draft was a real scary thing. I mean, it was like you get your wisdom teeth pulled and you file for the draft. And, you know, it was the luck of the draw whether you were going to live or die, go to be drafted and go to Vietnam, or you were going to get lucky enough to get into a good school and keep your grades up and have that military deferment. And I had a number of my friends, a couple guys I knew went to Canada, and, you know, many, many years later, of course, they were pardoned and they could come back. But they made a life for themselves in Canada. I had a good buddy of mine that lived across from I lived in a trailer when I went to Orange Coast College at my first 2 years of school. And Bobby was drafted, and he put braces on his teeth to get out of the draft. And it worked. So it was a little bit like what those characters wasn't as it wasn't to that same extent that Busey went to, and some of the guys putting braces on their legs to get out of the draft in that scene. But there was some similarities that were striking. You know,
sure.
It was mainly the fear factor. Everybody was afraid because, you know, different era. There's no draft now.
You know, one of the more interesting aspects of your character in Big Wednesday is, you know, your character is kind of like that quintessential John Ford aesthetic to him. And, you know, one thing I kind of find unsettling about the character is how he looks at, you know, how he comes home from the war after those 3 years, and he finds that this girl that he cared about has married someone else, and there isn't much reaction. So how do you think Barlow handled that, you know, what we don't see in the film?
Jack Barlow internalized things, you know. He was a thinker. And I think that appealed to John Milius' sense of storytelling, because he didn't want that character commenting so much. He wanted an audience to be thinking about and interpreting on kind of a canvas that everybody could interpret it differently.
Sure. And, you know, that final sequence in the film, you know, where the three of you are walking with your boards towards the water, I was curious to see, you know, what kind of direction did Milius give you guys for that scene?
That scene was really John Milius's ode to John Ford.
Right.
And some of the great Westerns. That's what that scene was about.
When I read this interview that you gave with Roger Ebert back in 1979, I think, and, you know, they had talked a little bit about just, you know, how horrible Big Wednesday did when it came out.
Yeah.
And you were very frustrated with that situation, you know.
Yeah.
Being involved in such a film, and it's clearly a film that you cared about working on, and so how does that make you feel? I mean, 'cause especially when all the reviews, you know, I kind of read some reviews and they called the characters in the film bland to a certain extent. So,
yeah.
I mean, how does that make you feel as an artist, as an actor, trying, you know, contributing something like this?
Well, now I can say in the aftermath, in all these ensuing years, I mean, Big Wednesday became a great cult classic and sold a bajillion DVDs, and I think John Milius felt very vindicated that it was heralded as one of the great films of that era, you know. And so I felt somewhat vindicated, but at the time, it always feels strange to be not appreciated, you know.
You know, last question about Big Wednesday, and it's really funny how, and I think you kind of, I recently read the Sports Illustrated article about Big Wednesday that I think you took part in, and you know, it's really funny how Big Wednesday, you know, life has sort of imitated art in a sense, that you have these three guys and what they go through, what they're going through, and, you know, and what they deal with. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. I mean, is this blown out of proportion, or is this just tragedy how, you know, life has imitated art in this way in terms of Big Wednesday?
It's really peculiar how, you know, Jan did kind of lose his way in life. And when last I saw Jan, Gary and I had taken him to a rehab. The last time I really spent any time with him, we had done, it was in New York on Howard. Yeah, we had done Howard Stern together. I was there, and Jan was on that. And then Howard had me on, and that was really the last time I saw him. We got him into a rehab. Gary and I saw him a little while after that. And then I completely lost touch with Jan, and I hear he's in Mississippi somewhere. And that is such a tragedy. And Gary is, but Gary has kind of become Gary Busey. Gary Busey is larger than life. He's reinvented himself as quite a celebrity. And I have kind of become the person that I always wanted. So, you know, I work in production now mainly. I work behind the scenes. I write and produce and help with this production company. I'm quiet, but that's more or less the way things turned out. I moved inland, raised a family, bought a house, did the whole thing, you know, like it said in the film. That's what happened to me.
You know, how do you think Big Wednesday, like, compares? I mean, how does it rank up there against other surf movies of the last 40 years?
Oh, I think it's head and shoulders above everything until recently. I think Soul Surfer was an extraordinary film. But here's the difference. Soul Surfer was about reaching down and it was about spirituality and faith and belief. And it was about all those other things. And Big Wednesday was about friendship.
Sure.
So they were about two different things. But I felt it was a brilliant film. But Big Wednesday was brilliant in another way, differently, you know. I'm sorry, I had to clarify that there were two different types of films, and the themes that they were trying to, that were ringing through in both films were different.
Sure.
But they were both very good surfing films.
So what is your very fondest memory of working at Big Wednesday?
My fondest memories? Well, my God, it was my life. I mean, that was my life. Big Wednesday was my life.
The ugly bruise of fear is swollen and festering.
A claw-fingered, scaly-skinned, half-human crustacean.
The black hole of despair. The clenched fist of doubt.
A frenzied bedlam of blood-curdling horror.
What if things were really getting better?
Hold on, folks. We're expressed to the top floor.
The Vertical Pandemonium Audio Theater. Only on mentalradio.net.
Okay, we're back. So, Justin, what are your top five surfing movies and why?
Okay. But, you know, this is going to be a toss-up because I actually love surfing movies, and I don't know why. It's, you know, so this list is a blend of documentary and fiction. So, you know, number five, there's this really great, and it's sort of really hard to find, but you can get it on DVD if you look in the right place. And it's just this documentary from Australia called Morning of the Earth, and it was done by this guy named Albert Felsen. And it's this Australian movie. It's just about these surfers that kind of go to Bali, and then they surf around Australia, and there's this really amazing music in it. And the music kind of, you know, is this sort of spiritual 70s rock, and you get this amazing cinematography, and it's just really hypnotic. It's sort of like, you know, I'm a huge fan of Endless Summer. What Morning of the Earth does is it takes like the concept of Endless Summer and takes it to the next level, sort of like modernizes it. So I really love that film. And then next up, I have Step Into Liquid, which is this great documentary done by Dana Brown. And Dana Brown is Bruce Brown's son, who of course did Endless Summer, and it's this great doc that documents all this surfing culture and passion around the world. Like, you know, it takes you to Wisconsin. It shows these weird guys that get dressed up in wetsuits and surf on Lake Michigan. And then, you know, it shows surfing in Vietnam, and it shows these three brothers that surf in Scotland. It's just so brilliant. So, and then I love North Shore. And then again, I mentioned twice Endless Summer. And then probably my favorite one is Big Wednesday.
So my top five surfing movies, I have no top five surfing movies. I really don't get into surfing films other than maybe like Surf Nazis Must Die because the amazing dialogue, but yeah, and I'm not even a big fan of Point Break. Sorry.
Well, hell, I mean, if you don't have a top five, I'm just gonna keep going then.
All right,
I have,
go for it.
I have so many. So, you know, I have, there's great stuff out there that people can get,
that, you know, these documentaries, they're just sort of fascinating and really well done. And, you know, there's this film called Five Summer Stories. And Castles in the Sky is really wonderful. A newer one called Riding Giants is really great. And then there's this one called Beyond Blazing Boards as well. You know, there's so many documentaries on surfing out there. You know, again, Bruce Brown, the guy who did he did Endless Summer, but he also did that really great, if you remember, the Steve McQueen documentary on Any Sunday is really great. And so, like, you know, he kind of broke the mold on surfing documentaries, you know, and pretty much everything that's followed has sort of just, you know, emulated his concept. And so with that, you know, we should probably talk about, like, how surfing has sort of evolved over the last 50 years on film. You know, going back to the 50s, you know, we're treated to, like, sort of short, you know, black and white surfing documentaries. And also then the 60s hit and you get the Frankie Nanette beach movies.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess I do have some favorite surf films then, because I totally forgot about those. And the surfing in those is just top notch. You know, they never fall off those boards. It's awesome.
Yes, this is true. Listen, I'm a huge fan of the Frankie Nanette movies. I love them to death. And then, you know, going farther, you know, you had surfing on television too. You had, like, you know, Hawaii Five-0. I think wasn't Magnum P.I. a surfer at one point? And then you had the Batman and the 60s TV series surfing as well. So, I mean, Big Wednesday was sort of like the first movie to come along that actually took surfing seriously. So I want to mention, too, really fast that there's this – it looks really amazing. There's this new documentary coming out. It was directed by this guy named Sam George, and it's called Hollywood Don't Surf. And it's evolution of surfing in Hollywood over the last 50 years. And it has interviews with Spielberg in it and Milius and Quentin Tarantino, of course. And it just looks at surfing on film over the last 50 years, and it focuses a lot of time on Big Wednesday, and so I'm just really excited to see it.
Yeah, I want to see that Surf Now, Apocalypse Later. I think that's what it's called.
I don't even know what that is. What is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's some little documentary short on Milius that sounds awesome. So,
oh, wow.
One of these days.
All right, we'll be right back.
This is Mr. T, and you're in the prediction booth with Mac and Justin.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
One of the 10 best films of the year. A high-octane mixture of outlandishly stylized camp and outrageously sensational shootouts. Outrageously exhilarating, guaranteed to tingle the most jaded moviegoer's palate. A film concocted with nitroglycerin, the combined energy of the Road Warrior, RoboCop, and the Terminator. The killer is great cinema. The Killer, a thriller comedy that will leave you breathless.
That was audio for next week's show, John Woo's The Killer.
You know, check out the show's official website, www.projection-booth.com.
And be sure to check out the show on iTunes, you know, maybe leave us a rating, some feedback. And also don't forget about Stitcher, which you can use on your mobile phone. And then there's Jackalope Radio.
Yeah, listen or download the show over at Jackalope. Each week our show replays there at Sundays at 6 p.m. Central. So listen and then...
listen again. And also if you want to call in and leave us some feedback, maybe we'll play it on the show or invite you on as a co-host. You can go on there and leave your opinions about the shows that we've done previously. We're especially looking for feedback on our Last Action Hero show. Do you love it? Do you hate it? Do you agree with me? Do you agree with Justin and Samurai? What is it? So give us a call at 734-274-5904. And Justin, what are you going to leave us with today?
Let's see. How about some Booker T?